Thank you for taking the time to listen to this tape. BC AD was recorded in April of 2001 in Orlando, Florida, at the National Annual Meeting of American Atheists Incorporated. Ron Barrier is the national spokesman for American Atheists. Ray Comfort is a Christian author. This message is non-copyright. Duplication is encouraged.
This is the format for the debate. Each person will get a 15-minute opening speech. They decided that Mr. Comfort would go first. Then there will be a 10-minute rebuttal each, and then an 8-minute rebuttal each, and a 5-minute closing each. Is that correct? Okay. We have somebody keeping time here, since it is quarter after. Mr. Comfort, would you like to begin?
Thank you very much for that welcome. I'd like to share firstly some life-changing statistics with you, so please listen very carefully. According to an unofficial account, in 1960 there were 216 Elvis impersonators in the United States. 1970, 2,400. 1980, an estimated 6,300. In 1992, 14,000. Which means by the year 2010, one in four people in the U.S. will be an Elvis impersonator. Exciting thought. And I'm sure that we can all agree that there is a big difference between the word black and what's commonly called the N word. One describes an ethnic group, the other has extremely negative connotations. In the same way, there's a big difference between the word Christian and the word religious. History shows that religion has been accompanied by ignorance, intolerance, and superstition. Religion has fought the progress of science and has been responsible for more wars than anything else in history. I detest religion, and I'd rather be called stumpy than religious. I say that because I'm not here representing Roman Catholicism or the traditional Protestant Church. They would no doubt distance themselves from me and my words as clearly as you and I would distance ourselves from a skunk with severe halitosis. Religious, according to Webster's Dictionary, is, quote, pertaining to or connected with a monastic or religious order. I am neither a monk, nor am I part of any religious order. Now, the risk of causing you to roll your eyes in expectation of what you may consider the usual nauseating arguments for God's existence, I'm going to give you my four-point outline, in which I'll present my case. Firstly, I'll present evidence of creation. Secondly, the evidence of the Bible. Thirdly, the evidence of personal experience. And fourth, the evidence of conscience. I'll be addressing your intellect, conscience, and then your ability to reason in that order. Firstly, the evidence of creation. Now, I'd like to share a theory I have with you, an intellectually stimulating theory. It's my theory of where the Coca-Cola can may have come from. Billions of years ago, there was a Big Bang in space. Nobody knows what caused the Big Bang. It just happened. From the Big Bang, it shot this huge rock in space. And as it spun through space and cooled down, there was found some sweet brown bubbly liquid on the top. And over millions of years, aluminum crept up the side, formed itself into a can, then a lid, and then a tab. And then over millions of years, red paint, white paint, and a little bit of red paint fell from the sky and formed itself in the words, Coca-Cola, 12 fluid ounces, do not litter. Saying, man, what are you doing? You're insulting my intellect. And so I am. You know, if the Coca-Cola can is made, there must be a maker. If you know it's designed, there must be a designer. To believe this happened by chance, by accident, is to move into an intellectual free zone. It's to have an echo when you think. It's to have brain liposuction. Behold, the atheist's nightmare. Now, if you study a well-made banana, of which this is, you'll find on the far side, there are three ridges. On the close side, two ridges. If you get your hand ready to grip a banana, you'll find on the far side, three grooves. On the close side, two grooves. The banana and the hand are perfectly made one for the other. You'll find a banana has been designed with a non-slip surface. It has outward indicators of inward contents. Green, too early. Yellow, just right. Black, too late. Now, if you go to the top of the banana, you'll find, as with a Coca-Cola can, the designers placed a tab at the top for ease of entrance. So the creator of the banana has designed it with a tab of top. When you pull the tab, the contents don't squirt in your face. The wrapper, which, by the way, is biodegradable, has perforations like your pad paper. Notice how gracefully it sits over the human hand. Notice the point at the top for ease of entry, just the right shape for the human mouth. If you chewy, palatable, good for you, easy to digest, and the Maker, Almighty God, has even curved it toward the face to make the whole process so much easier. Folks, you've got infinite chance more of convincing me no one designed the Coca-Cola can as you have of convincing me there's no God. The whole of creation testifies to the genius of God's creative hand. Now, I believe in physical fitness, as you can tell from my physique. For many years, I ran to work and from work every day, without fail. Well, actually, my office was 10 feet from my back door, but I did run that distance. Now, between my back door and my office, there was this huge avocado tree, and it would regularly drop leaves. One day, while running to work, I stopped for rest under the avocado tree, and I noticed there were 7 leaves on the ground. So I put those 7 leaves in a straight line, went into my office, sat down, and waited for my wife to come in and say what I thought she would say. It was very predictable. She walked in, sat down, and said, "What did you put those leaves like that for?" You see, there was no way her reasoning mind could believe that 7 leaves fell off the tree and went into a straight line of 7 leaves. She knew that an intelligent mind had put them there. And when you look at creation, you can see order from the atom through to the universe. Could I ever convince you that my car had no maker? You come up and say, "It's a nice car. What make is it?" I say, "I didn't have a make. Fell together at the back of a yard. Took millions of years." What are you saying? You see, you can see it's been designed with purpose in mind. You've got a windshield to stop bees hitting you. You've got windshield wipers to smudge the bees. You've got little squirters to smudge them further. In fact, I had a friend who got a pair of pliers and turned the squirters to the side so he could hit pedestrians. But look at the human eye. It's a windshield. 137 million light-sensitive cells. You've got windshield wipers. They don't go and get on your nerves. They come down so fast, you don't even see it happen. Yours have worked, irrespective, if you will, about 50 times since I began speaking. You have little squirters called tear ducts, which unfortunately can't be turned to the side to hit pedestrians. But they keep everything lubricated. We're fearfully, wonderfully made, and there is tremendous order throughout the whole of creation. Sir Isaac Newton said, "This most beautiful system of the sun, the planets, the comets, could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being." But I mean, how do you scientifically prove the existence of God? Very simply. The English word scientific comes from the Latin word to make knowledge. So let me make knowledge and show you how you can prove God's existence scientifically. When I look at this building, how can I know there was a builder? I mean, what proof is there of a builder? You can't see him, hear him, touch him, taste him, or smell him. What proof is there? Well, the building is proof there was a builder. You couldn't want better proof there was a builder than to have the building as evidence. You don't need faith to believe in a builder. All you need is eyes that can see and a brain that works. It goes like this: building, duh, builder. Now, the same deep, rich intellectual principle works with paintings and painters. When I look at a painting, how can I know there was a painter? Well, the painting is absolute 100% scientific proof there was a painter. You couldn't want better proof there was a painter than to have the painting as evidence. You don't need faith to believe in a painter. All you need is eyes that can see and a brain that works. And exactly the same applies to the existence of God. The Bible says, "For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." Scientist Stephen Hawking said in his book, A Brief History of Time, "It would be very difficult to explain why the universe should have just begun in this way, except as the act of a God who intended to create beings like us." Albert Einstein didn't believe in the God of the Bible, but he wasn't a fool. He knew there was a creator. He said, "God does not play dice with the universe." He also said, "Everyone who is seriously interested in the pursuit of science becomes convinced that a spirit is manifest in the laws of the universe, a spirit vastly superior to man, and one in the face of which our modest powers must feel humble." The existence of God is axiomatic. It is self-evident. And arguing about God's existence is intellectually demeaning. It's like arguing with the sun is not hot club about whether or not the sun is hot. That's why the Bible says the fool has said in his heart there's no God. So firstly, we've looked at the evidence of creation. Secondly, we'll look briefly at the evidence of the Bible. Now, I think I've heard every argument against the Bible. Arguments such as, Jesus taught hatred. Adam didn't die the day that God said he would. The Bible teaches that the earth is flat. The Bible is full of atrocities. God murdered innocent people. Hare don't chew their own cud. Bats aren't birds. 2 accounts of the death of Judas. The contradiction between eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and turn the other cheek. These arguments is about as impressive as a two-man wave at the Super Bowl. Then there's legitimate questions, to which has a legitimate answer. Questions like, why does God allow evil? Doesn't suffering prove that there's no loving God? Who made God? And the old favorite, can God make a rock that he cannot lift? Many of these are dealt with in my book, How to Make an Atheist Backslide, of which we have free copies in your book room for you. These contentions merely confirm the biblical truth that the natural man, that is the unconverted man, receives not the things of the Spirit of God, neither can he know them. They are foolishness to him because they're spiritually understood. And isn't it true? The things of God are foolishness to us until we are converted. And then God opens our eyes to his word. The Bible suddenly comes alive and we become aware of the reality of God. And if we have problems with parts of the Bible, we need to listen to the wise words of Mark Twain, who said, most people are bothered by those scriptures or passages of scriptures they don't understand. But for me, I've always noticed that the passages that bother me are those that I do understand. And he was right. It's not the things that men don't understand about the Bible that really bother them. It's the things they can understand. And folks, I've been reading the Bible every day without fail for 29 years. And I can testify that it is packed with scientific, indisputable, unchanging scientific and prophetic facts. You can laugh, but we have a free booklet here for you, packed with these undisputable scientific facts. And we're going to offer it to you, but you won't take it. I'll tell you why. Because atheists are afraid of scientific facts that are unchanging. See, what you believe about science today will be laughed at in about 100 years, because science continually changes its mind. You see, the old argument, you can't prove the Bible by quoting the Bible, that circular reasoning argument, is absurd. That's like saying, you can't prove the president lives in the White House by looking into the White House. It's by looking into the White House that provides the necessary proof. And you can prove the Bible as supernatural in origin merely by checking it out. Don't be prejudiced. Don't believe what people tell you. Be open-minded. Just check it out for yourself. Check it out. Because I was once a skeptic. I was once an evolutionist. And God transformed my mind, as I'll share with you a little later. And if you change your mind afterward, and you do want to see those scientific facts, just check them out on our website, raycomfort.com. Read them for yourself. Be open to reason. Don't be prejudiced. Thank you.
As Jack Benny would say, well. Took about 10 minutes to get into ad hominems, appeals to emotion, appeals to feeling, fearing guilt. Thus we see that the arguments for God run out in about 10 minutes. The question before us is there a God? Not whether the Bible is true or bananas are shaped for the mouth. I'm not a smart guy. I'm not a philosopher. I'm not a theologian. I'm a meat and potatoes or a vegetarian guy just like you. And I particularly don't like debating with theologians, because the God of the theologian is not the God of the people. And for that, I appreciate that you're not taking this highfalutin approach to it. So let's get down in the trenches. We're going to dispense with the usual anthropic and theological and ontological nonsense and get into something we can talk about. If there is a God, well, all things that exist require an environment. No matter how small or how large, from the tiniest microbe to the largest galaxy, there is an environment in which that thing must interact, or else it doesn't exist. We have plants on the surface. In fact, up to just a few years ago, we thought that all life on Earth really depended on photosynthesis. That is, we derived our energy from the sun. Recently, we found now that there are life forms that live in the bottom of the sea by these hot vents that live off sulfur and other chemicals. They do not rely on the sun. So these were an alien life form that we previously did not know exist, but now they do, but they have an corresponding environment. So thus, this God should also have a corresponding environment. These are not mine. I thought that was it. I thought I was being taken away. There was no rapture at that point. Praise. But what we do know is that when we were primitive and we first realize who we are and who we were, and we recognize our mortality, we started to attach special significance to those things we didn't understand. In the early days, gods lurked everywhere. They were in the soil, in the rocks, in the trees, in the birds, and the animals, and there was a god for this, and a god for that, and a god of the wind, and all sorts of other things. Well, we started to learn about the natural world around us. And the gods slowly stepped back and started hanging out at the tops of mountains. We continued to probe the depths of nature and the mystery that we find ourselves in. Well, now the gods have moved up above the clouds, because we're now climbing mountains and there is no god. Of course, now that we're able to fly and we're able to send probes deep into space, of course, now God is way out there. In fact, he lives in an environment called supernatural. Now, the theist is fond of saying that by the atheist claiming there is no God, that is a claim to total knowledge. Nonsense. That is a claim to the knowledge we have about the natural world around us and our relationship to it. However, to say that something is supernatural, to say that it exists beyond nature, is in fact a claim of complete knowledge, because what you are saying is that you understand every conceivable physical law under every reaction in every area of the physical universe. That is the claim of knowledge of the theist. Does God eat? Does he eat bananas? After all, he made them. Does he consume energy? Does he expel waste? Can he do any of the things that we have to do in order to exist? Does he breathe? All of these principles I call my principle of environmental incompatibility. Now I'm going to move on to a principle of what I call perceived communication. Living beings, no matter what they are, communicate. We know that dolphins can communicate using sound waves. So do whales. We know that ants communicate with chemical signals. We even understand now, under latest scientific research, by the way, this is the scientific research we're going to laugh at in 100 years, that plants, when they are under attack by an insect predator, actually release a chemical to warn other plants of its species of these insects. The remaining plants secrete a chemical repelling the insects. My friends, that is evolution. But the perceived communication that the theist seems to think somehow travels beyond the speed of light, and it's called prayer. Now, how this being, whatever he may be, can communicate with billions of other beings simultaneously, picking and choosing which will he will reply to and which ones he will not, in some sort of incredibly fast matrix of subspace interlinks with living beings throughout the universe is unproven, and therefore we can throw it out. There was also, and we heard in the last 5 minutes of Mr. Comfort's assessments, what I call the principle of unwarranted necessities. Number one, the fact that God belief requires that you submit intellectually. That seems to fly in the face of the same claim that we have free will. You can have free will and submit intellectually, but they would have it both ways. There is emotional involvement. Now, reality, you know, let's go to Forrest Gump, all right? Reality is what reality is. You don't have to believe, belief or emotional involvement with our reality is not necessary. Let me just use a little example. When people ask me, do you believe in life on other planets? It's a false question. If there's life on other planets, what does it matter whether we believe in it or not? Our belief does not legitimize it, and our non-belief does not negate it. But the question is there life? Well, we don't know. We haven't gotten to that point yet. But belief should be totally unnecessary. Of course, there's my favorite, the personal relationship syndrome, which I still is beyond me how someone can perceive to have a personal relationship with something that is non-human and, in many opinions, inhuman, that is invisible, that is lives in the land of supernaturalia, but yet they have a person. My father died 6 years ago. I can't have a personal relationship with him now, and he's only 10 feet away in the grave. Never mind living somewhere out there being invisible. The argument of suffering and pain. I don't buy that if there's suffering, a God doesn't exist. Actually, I think the two are mutually exclusive. One has nothing to do with the other. Obviously, if this God was going to test us with suffering, it's kind of ridiculous, because if you're going to go to a place that there's no suffering, then why do you need suffering? We can skip that whole step. Mr. Comfort gave us a nice rundown of the number of Elvis impersonators we have in the United States. He defined Christianity, and I, like him, am not religious. So we're on the same side on that little thing. However, there is an example where, in fact, a Coca-Cola has stimulated religious belief. And in the movie The Gods Must Be Crazy, a Coca-Cola bottle fell from the sky, and a whole tribe believed that it was a sign of a god. When they found out that we were the gods, the man went back into the bush. His evidence of a banana being perfect for the human hand. Well, again, that only reminds me of Voltaire, that said the nose was perfectly designed to put on the wrong glasses. Or that a gorilla's or our nostrils are perfectly formed to accommodate our fingers. How much time do I have? Okay. He gives us the analogy that if there is a building, there must be a builder. Of course, we're in complete agreement with that. If there's a car, there must be a car maker. I agree. If there's a painter, there must be a painter. Of course, I agree. And of course, the most famous one, the watch. If you have a watch, there must be a watchmaker. I agree with those things. But the difference between a watch maker and his watch, and what he perceives to be a god and his creation, is that, number one, the watchmaker did not create the materials he used to make the watch. He made the watch from pre-existing materials, which he molded and formed and accommodated using machinery that he also took other materials to make the watch. The other point is that the watchmaker made the watch with pride. He made it to outlast him. He made it as a testimony to his artisanship. Now, considering, of course, that God is omnipotent and exists all over the place, things are dropping faster than he can make them. At no point does a painter create colors except by mixing other colors, or a building goes up by itself. His uses of Hawking and Einstein are disingenuous, as both men in their writings have expressed that they do not believe in a supernatural entity. And then he says, finally, wrapping it up, that arguing about a god is intellectually demeaning. If we don't exist, why did you come to argue? I think we saw that the last 5 minutes really were preaching, appeals to your emotions. Of course, the usual insults, Psalms 14:1, which they never complete, you know. That the is the fool who says that there is no God, and he is corrupt, and he does wicked things, and none of them do good. They never say that in public. So, I would have to say that I don't accept a God, there is no God, and my opponent has not demonstrated at all yet evidence to support a God other than using articles of faith or using the Bible, both things which he said he would not do. Thank you.
Thank you, Ron. I'm actually enjoying myself. Food for thought. Now I'd like to present evidence of personal experience. I wasn't converted by the Bible, Well, neither were the early Christians converted by the Bible. The New Testament wasn't compiled. Many couldn't read. There was no such thing as the printing press. The early Christians and myself were converted by the invisible power of God. April the 25th, 1972, 1:30 in the morning, I came to know God. I didn't hear voices. I didn't see visions. Psychiatric wards are full of people that see visions and hear voices. I did not see any. Neither have I heard any voices or seen visions since I became a Christian. Let me share a very simple analogy with you. A little boy was looking at a heater. His father came in and said, "Son, that heater's hot. Don't touch it." The kid says, "Okay, okay." At that point in time, the child has an intellectual assent the heater is hot. He believes the heater is hot. Dad goes out the room. The kid thinks, "I wonder if it really is hot." So he reaches out his hand and touches the heater bar. The stick in his flesh burns. He stops believing the heater's hot. He now knows it's hot. He's moved out of the realm of belief into the realm of personal experience. Now, before I was a Christian, I believed in the existence of God. I was not foolish. I could see creation, creator. The 25th of April, 1972, 1:30 in the morning, I reached out and touched the heater bar of God's love and mercy and moved out of the realm of belief into the realm of experience. Back to the heater analogy. Let's say a heater expert walks in and says, "Kid, that heater's not hot. I'm an expert." Kid would say, "Get out of here." Because he's not in the realm of belief, he's in the realm of experience. And it's been well said, a man with an experience is not at the mercy of a man with an argument. Now, on your website, I noticed in reference to Mr. Barrier, this quote. Ron spoke of experiences of being a Christian for nearly 35 years. Increasingly, though, he saw little or no point in much of the rituals he was engaged in. So, according to that statement, Ron knew the Lord for 35 years. You see, his admission puts him into a terrible dilemma for an atheist. If he knew the Lord, which is what a Christian is, the Bible says, "This is eternal life, that they might know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent," then he's in a big dilemma because he's supposed to be an atheist. So he is forced to say that he thought he knew the Lord, but he was deceived. He's then admitting that he didn't know the Lord and was therefore never a Christian. He was merely pretending. And I don't know how he lasted for 35 years, but our churches are full of such people. Now, I don't know if you realize, but we, as human beings, are prone to error. The man who put the eraser on the end of the pencil knew what he was doing. With that thought in mind, let me give you the atheist test. I'm going to ask you two questions that seem kind of dumb, but they're important. The first question is, do you know how many pieces of sand are on the islands of Hawaii? You say, "Oh, no." Okay, second question. How many hairs are on the back of a fully grown male Tibetan yak? Do you know? I doubt it. See, there are some people who think they know everything, but there are things we don't know. Thomas Edison, with his brilliant mind, said, "We do not know 1/1,000,000% about anything." You see, the statement "there is no God" is an absolute statement. To make an absolute statement, for that statement to be true, I need absolute knowledge. Let me give you an example. Here is an absolute statement. There is no gold in China. Now, what do I need for that statement to be true? I need absolute knowledge. I need to know there's no gold in China for the statement to be true. I need to know there's no gold in any rock, any riverbed beneath the soil. I need to be able to see into every Chinaman's mouth, because if there's one gold filling, then my statement is not true. To make an absolute statement for it to be true, I need absolute knowledge. Now, the statement "there is gold in China" doesn't need absolute knowledge. I just need to see in a Chinaman's mouth, see one gold filling, and say, "Oh yeah, there's gold in China." Now let's say this circle represents all the knowledge in the universe. Someone who has all knowledge is omniscient. He knows everything about everything. He knows how many hairs are on everybody's head, every thought, every heart. Every atom is displayed before him. He sees all history before him. He knows all about the secret love life of the fleas on the back of Napoleon's great-grandmother's black cat. Nothing is hid from his eyes. Let's say you know an incredible 1% of all the knowledge in the universe. An incredible 1%. Is it possible, in the 99% of the knowledge you haven't yet come across, that there is ample evidence to prove that God does indeed exist? And if you're reasonable, you'll have to say, "Yes, it is possible. In the 99% of the knowledge I haven't yet come across, there is ample evidence to prove that God exists." So you're forced to say, "With the limited knowledge I have at present, I've come to the conclusion there's no God. But I really don't know." So you're not an atheist. You're agnostic. And I say this with all due respect. The Latin equivalent for the word agnostic is ignoramus, which adequately sums up the intellectual capacity of a man who looks at a building and doesn't know if there was a builder. I wonder if you would sell one of your eyes for $1 million. Imagine if I said, I was an eye doctor, I'm doing eye transplants. We can transplant one of your eyes in 1 hour pain-free operation and give you a glass eye that will look as good as this eye, just won't look as good as this eye. You'll be blind in one eye, but we'll give you $1 million for one of your eyes. Would you sell an eye for $1 million? Some of you would probably say, yeah, here's the crunch. We want a matching pair, they must be fresh. Would you sell both your eyes for $10 million? $20 million? You say, $20 million? Whoa, now I can see the world! You don't see a thing if you sell both your eyes. And I guarantee nobody in his right mind would ever sell his eyes for $20 million, $50 million, $100 million. Your eyes are priceless to you. How much more worth is your life? A friend of mine, his name is Craig, he's 20 years old, had no interest in the things of God at all. Absolutely none. So one day his doctor said, son, you've got cancer. To test your cancer. He said, I'll give you 6 months to live. His friend said to him, do a brothel crawl. That is, go to a whorehouse, enjoy the last 6 months of your life. He wasn't interested. Why? Because he had a cry within his heart that was stronger than his sexual drive. It was his will to live. Something in him said, oh, I don't want to die. Now you and I can identify with that because we have a will to live. Each of us. And if there was just one chance in a million that the Bible's right when it says Jesus Christ has abolished death and brought life and immortality to light through the gospel, you owe it to your good sense to listen. Folks, if you're an atheist, you're wearing someone else's glasses. You're not seeing things clearly. Thank you.
Carl Sagan, in his book, The Demon-Haunted World, has a very illuminating chapter in it, which I always recommend to young people, to not only get the book and read it from, you know, pick it up at the library and read it, but to read this one particular chapter. And that chapter is called The Baloney Detection Kit. And it would seem that Dr. Sagan wrote that with the previous arguments in mind. We saw repeatedly here not evidence for a God, but appeals to emotions, appeals to our mortality. We save our lives. Death is imminent. Death, things like that do not scare atheists. Death is a continuum of life. Death is necessary to life. If everyone was eternal, first of all, I couldn't even conceive of people living forever. I mean, they're just going to keep getting born and born and born and born. And eventually, I guess you're going to have to be crowded out somewhere, really, one way or another. We also see, again, the arguments, the ad hominem attacks on our position. The fallacy with the building-builder routine again. We already said we know if we see a building, there was a builder. My brother-in-law was the builder. But that's the fallacy of illicit redefinition, because he's trying to take the word building and build or paint or make and turn it into the word create. As if somehow we create things. The hairs on the yak analogy, the sands and all this about complete knowledge, these obviously, even in the world of critical thinking, there are certain things that we do accept without proof. But we accept them on certain conditions. Somebody once said to me, you have faith when you step in an elevator. And I said, well, no, I don't. When that door opens, I look first. However, I do realize that elevators do work. They're inspected regularly. We have a system set up for that, so we don't have to worry about the mechanics of the elevator. I mean, there are instances where the doors have opened and the elevator has not been there, and people just go in, boom. That's reality. But what he's trying to do is somehow to establish that personal experience is a valid way of learning. However, even personal experience does not justify theism. We see blue skies, even though we know they're not blue, because we know the underlying premise behind them. in his book, he talks about, well, you know, if you're a real atheist and you can't accept anything, then you have to inspect every cornflake under a microscope and every piece of raisin in your raisin bandbox to make sure that it's raisins. But the point is, we do accept certain things without proof, but we have mechanisms in place to guarantee that that final product is something we can consume. If that change from the corn in the field to the cornflake in our bowl breaks down one way or the other, and there's disease, we go back to see where the system broke down. And we go back and we go to fix that. Doesn't mean you have faith in cornflakes. He said he had something happen to him at 2:30 in the morning some night. I don't know what that was. I remember when I was a young man, I was always wishing something would happen to me at 2:30 in the morning. Now, being married 25 years, I'm snoring at 2:30 in the morning. The key here, though, is where external validation is unavailable, then we cannot correct error, and something is not subject to falsifiability. Sure, I may not really be here. My brain could be in a jar somewhere, and some scientist is implanting a fantasy land in my head, just like the machines in the movie Matrix. But until I have better evidence to even support that, I figure I'm here, and so are you. So let's deal with it. They like to pick and choose how this particular God interacts with the physical world. However, they never describe how he manages to interact with the physical world, just that he does. So, of course, if a woman or a person, actually say a person, winds up feeding a hungry person because God told them, everybody feels that's a good thing. But if someone kills someone, they strap bombs to themselves and they go stand to a school bus full of young children in the glory of God, people dismiss him as a nut. I guess the only rule of thumb is that if it makes us feel good, that's it. Of course, that's the Buddy Christ theory of the movie Dogma, for those of you who might have seen that one. Analogies, like Mr. Comfort uses, and like we all use, even scientists, are very illustrative tools, and they do help us to understand things. However, they cannot form the backbone of an argument by itself. They prove nothing. Richard Feynman, in and of himself, considered one of the greatest minds since Einstein, in his book, Six Easy Pieces. They talk about a class that he is conducting. And one of his rules for clear thinking was that one cannot prove an idea using the same data that suggests the idea, which is exactly what the theist does. He uses the Bible to prove it's real. Well, it is real. It's a real book. But I can go to a Stephen King novel, I can go to a Clive Barker novel, I can go to a John Grisham novel, and I can go ahead and I can pull out all sorts of things that are very real. Real cities. These are real people who lived at real times. These are real events that may have occurred. Doesn't make the novel real, though. Makes the story fiction. We have to be very careful when we listen to these arguments of God, because essentially, and I will stay by this, it is the theist who adds this affectation to our lives, and then somehow we have to disprove it. However, that is the fallacy of the argument from ignorance. God exists simply because no one has ever disproved him. And since there is no proof against God, well then, he must be. That is a complete fallacy of critical thinking that would be thrown out in the highest institutions of learning, and is a pariah in scientific thinking. Thank you.
Thank you, Ron. We've looked at the evidence of creation, the evidence of the Bible, the evidence of personal experience. Now I want to look to the evidence of the conscience. I'm going to move from addressing your intellect and speak directly to your conscience. And this is because the word conscience means with knowledge. Con is with, science is knowledge. The Bible says that everyone has a conscience. Every one of us is born with an inner knowledge. I've yet to hear of an ignorant, savage tribe being atheistic. They're not that ignorant. They're not fools. They know if there's a creation, there must be a creator. And in their ignorance, they worship an idol, the sun, water, stone. Why? Because God has given the light of conscience to every man and woman. Author Michael Pearl said, when a man calls himself an atheist, he's not attacking God, he is attacking his conscience. You see, if your conscience is allowed to do its duty, it will speak to you of God's existence. But if you deny that inner knowledge, according to the Bible, your conscience is seared. That means it's deadened on the outside. So I'm going to speak directly to the conscience in an effort to resurrect it. And to do this, I'm going to use the Ten Commandments, or what's commonly called the law of God. Now, God's law is like a mirror. When you and I got up this morning, the first thing we probably did was go to the mirror and look into it. Why did we do that? We wanted to see what damage had been done during the night. And when we see an outstanding hairstyle, puffy eyes and a pale face, once we see ourselves in truth, we see we need cleansing and go from the mirror to the water to wash. So what we're going to do is hold up God's law as a mirror. Now, folks, it's not a pretty sight. You're not going to like this, but it won't last long. It's most necessary to present my case for the existence of God, so please bear with me. Now, would you consider yourself to be a good person? Knowing from experience, most of you will say, yeah, I'm a good person. Well, let me hold up the mirror to see if you are morally clean. Have you kept the Ten Commandments? You say, I don't believe in the Ten Commandments. I'm not asking you if you believe in them. I'm saying, have you kept them? Have you ever told a lie? You say, ah, yes, that's why, yes, yes. What does that make you? It makes you a liar. Have you ever stolen something? You say, ah, yeah, just little things. What does that make you? It makes you a thief, because the value of that which you've stolen is totally irrelevant. And here's the third question, and this is the clincher. Jesus said, whoever looks upon a woman to lust after her has committed adultery already with her in his heart. So if you said you've done that, we can't help it, us guys. We are slaves to it. If you said yes to each of those questions, then you're a lying, thieving, adulterate heart, and you have to face God on Judgment Day whether you believe in him or not. You say, I don't believe in Judgment Day. Doesn't make any difference whether we believe in Judgment Day or not. You see, I remember being faced with that mirror 29 years ago and seeing that I had broken all those commandments in spirit, if not in letter. The Bible says you hate someone, you're a murderer. If there's hatred in your heart, God considers that to be murder. I hadn't put God first. I made a God to suit myself. I hadn't given honors to his name. I hadn't kept the Sabbath holy. I dishonored my parents through rebellion. And I've broken all those commandments we've just spoken of. And I knew if I faced God on Judgment Day, whether I believed it or not, I'd be guilty and I'd end up in hell. And that's when I heard the gospel for the first time in my life. I took someone else's glasses off and I began to see things clearly. The good news of the gospel, that Christ died for our sins, which you know, living in America. That's what we celebrate on Good Friday, that Christ died for our sins, took the punishment. He was bruised for our iniquities. The Bible says God commended his love toward us, and that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Then he rose from the dead and defeated death. And he can deliver us from not only the power of death, but the fear of death. You see, if I don't believe in hell or judgment, it doesn't make a difference. If I stand on a freeway and say I don't believe in trucks, if I don't get off the freeway, I'm going to run down. It's true, isn't it? When I first became a Christian, I was not dressed like this. This is reasonably tastefully dressed. I used to be into the surf scene, and I think the idea with surfers is you try and look as much like seaweed as you can. I had hair on my shoulders, there were bright corduroy orange pants and bright turquoise shirts. That's why I was surprised when a 91-year-old Presbyterian minister walked into my surf shop, said, I hear you've become a Christian, shook my hand. He had $10 in his hand. I liked that man from the moment I met him. But we built a friendship for the next 2 years. He was 91, I was in the counterculture, 22, and we were just so close. One day his wife called and said, George is about to die. Would you come and be with us at this time? So I said, sure. Went around there. As I walked in, she was on the phone. The phone was right by the bedroom door. It had a very loud ring because George was partly deaf. I went and sat down next to George. He didn't have his teeth and I thought he had left us. I held his hand. And he said, is that you, Ray? I said, yes, it is. He said, Ray, I'm going to go be with Jesus. And I sat down and thought, wow, what a privilege I have to be present when a saint goes marching through to glory. You see, a saint isn't someone who's been dead for 200 years with fat babies at fly shoulder height. A saint is anyone who puts their faith in Jesus Christ. God forgives sins. He perfects. And I sat there for 20 minutes thinking, how will he go? How will he go? I wonder how he will go, because he was real close. Suddenly, after 20 minutes, he lifted his right hand to the sky, pointed to the heavens and said, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Oh. I thought, man, what a way to go. Suddenly the phone rang, he sat up, and I was the one that just about died. He lasted another 2 years. But folks, at his funeral, I attended. And when he did go, we sung, "To God be the glory, great things he has done. So loved be the world that he gave us his son, who yielded his life in atonement for sin, and opened the life gate that all may go in." Thank you.
Well, I was very sick one time, and a doctor told me I had 6 months to live. I didn't pay him. He gave me another 6 months. Just because the idea of a God is conceivable does not mean that it is either correct or deserves our sustained attention. We've been called a number of things tonight. And arrogance is also one of the words that is used against us. And it's usually said that we're too arrogant to accept the existence of a God or his gift of love, or, which I've forgotten, I'm going to have to revise one of my principles, his ability to reproduce human beings without sexual contact. So they claim that we are arrogant or too arrogant to accept a universal intelligence, and that we will be held accountable for our actions and for this arrogance. But yet, what is really arrogant? Our honesty at simply not understanding and not knowing? Or rather, what I would think is that the much greater arrogance is the presumption that not only is there an all-powerful, all-knowing being who has total command over time and space and history and everything else, but that we short-lived and imperfect little beings are the focus of this being's attention, and that the underlying purpose of creation is our well-being. Well, I have to agree with Carl Sagan. There is nothing to suggest that the universe exists solely to satisfy human ambition. That is arrogance. We have to grow up sometime because, like spoiled little children, we can't feel that we're the center of attention all the time. We are on our own. Life is not fair, and nature does not nurture. I think it was Stephen Jay Gould who said one of the biggest mistakes we ever made was to add nurture to nature. We are here for a reason. If there are reasons, we don't know them. But the simple fact is that we are. And we have no alternative but to deal with the reality that we find ourselves in. And once we grasp that reality, then I could hope to think that these silly ideas that all the various religions have been throwing at us for thousands of years, and that they seem to have dragged us into their crazy and brutal and bloody wars, and how they used this type of philosophy to justify any action conceivable, then we will not progress. But it is only since the Enlightenment, since the 18th century, since the advancement of science, that we have been able to progress. And so, as we have evolved, not only physically but intellectually, we can see that religion has evolved too. Because every time scientifically we find out something, the religious takes that argument and says, "Aha, we knew it." Well, if they knew it, why did they wait 250 million years to find, for us to find out? The analogies of somehow, not believing in trucks. Of course we don't believe in trucks. A truck is on that highway whether you believe it or not. Now, if you're going to keep your eye out and look for a truck, that's what you're supposed to do. The truck exists not because you believe it exists. And you cannot unbelieve it to unexist. So I don't understand these analogies of taking already prefabricated things that we know about and trying to backtrack them and construct a phony argument to support a phony premise, and that is that this thing apparently lived alone by himself for an immeasurable length of time, then decided, well, he's going to make a race of beings, but he has complete knowledge. So he knew he was going to make a race of beings anyway, and he knew what's going to happen to those beings. If a being has total and complete knowledge, I don't know what you can do with that. Obviously, you are inert. You cannot make a decision. If you try to make a decision, it's been decided already. It's like the whole issue with prayer. They pray for God to do something. Well, what was he going to do? Change his mind? If he changed his mind, then he didn't know that was going to happen. He had to reassess his position. It's like the fine-tuning argument, I love fine-tuning of the universe. He just didn't quite get it right at first. Reminds me of the Far Side cartoon, where the author has a young man in front of a table and there's feathers all over the place and he has a black face and it was a god at his first attempt at inventing a chicken. You cannot, there is no way to even prove that there is something external that is imposing itself on our existence. Something that is aware, something that is self-conscious, something that knows it exists. There's simply no way to prove it. And the more insistence by those who believe in it for us to accept it only raises my level of suspicion. Because when science shows that something is true, contingently, it is. Doesn't depend on your belief. And no one's going to kick you behind if you don't like it. That's the way reality works. So, again, we've been at it here for a little over an hour. We have heard personal attacks. We have heard appeals to emotion, appeals to our mortality and personal experience. But not one single shred of testifiable evidence to suggest that we are the product of an inconceivable entity from beyond reality. Thank you.
First, I'd like to apologize if I called anybody here arrogant. I wasn't aware that I had, and I will study the videotape afterwards. And I do apologize if I did.
Ignorant.
Yeah, it was ignorant, not arrogant. Ignorant just means lacking knowledge. So I do apologize if it was arrogant, but I will check. Finally, I'd just like to speak of something that Ron spoke of, the subject of evolution you mentioned earlier on. I'd like you to realize that I do believe in something called microevolution. That is the variation within the species. Some dogs do appear to have evolved from large to small or small to large. But actually no evolution is taking place, they're still dogs. I don't believe there's any evidence for macroevolution, what's commonly called the theory of evolution. Let me tell you why. Professor Louis Bonnoir, the director of research at the National Center of Scientific Research, so rightly stated, evolution is a fairy tale for grown-ups. This theory has helped nothing in the progress of science. It is useless. Sir Arthur Keith, who wrote the foreword for the 100th edition of Origin of the Species, said evolution is unproved and unprovable. Malcolm Muggeridge, the famous British journalist and philosopher, said, I myself am convinced that the theory of evolution, especially to the extent to which it's been applied, will be one of the greatest jokes in the history books of the future. Dr. Tien Tamisian of the Atomic Energy Commission said, scientists who go about teaching that evolution is a fact of life are great con men, and the story they're telling may be the greatest hoax ever. USA Today, March 21st, 2001. Quote, paleontologists have discovered a new skeleton in the closet of human ancestry that is likely to force science to revise, if not scrap, current theories of human origins. Reuters reported that the discovery left, quote, scientists of human evolution confused, saying Lucy may not even be a direct human ancestor after all. You see, the phrase scientists of human evolution is an oxymoron. Evolution isn't scientific, it's a theory. Dr. Kent Hovind, who is a personal friend and I can vouch to his integrity, Dr. Kent Hovind offers $250,000 to anyone who can offer any scientific evidence for evolution, for the theory of evolution. Now, this is your chance. Take him to court. American atheists, no doubt, could muster the resources to do so. Make this another Scopes trial. Become famous. But you won't, because you can't. If you want his website address, just go to raycomfort.com. We'll put a link to it. You can go straight to it. See, all you have is faith in a theory. Evolution is actually a religion. Let me tell you why. The dictionary says this. A religion is, quote, according to the dictionary, a set of beliefs concerned with explaining the origins and purposes of the universe. The belief of evolution has its own religious language. Listen to the language you are forced to use if you are an evolutionist. We believe, perhaps, maybe, probably, could have, possibly. The founding father of the faith is Charles Darwin. The god of the religion is referred to by the faithful as Mother Nature. It was Mother Nature who was responsible for all this creation we see around us. And what's more, she's very attractive to sinful men. They gravitate to her like a moth to a flame. Why? Because she's deaf, she's blind, and she's mute. Mother Evolution doesn't hear anything, she doesn't see anything, and what's most important, she doesn't say anything. Mother Nature doesn't have any moral dictates. So if you make her your creator, you can do anything you want. That's why this bumper sticker, which I purchased, is so appropriate. Atheists do it without guilt. Every sinful pleasure you want to indulge in, you can do without qualms of conscience if you have evolution as your religion. Such a belief is called idolatry. It's making a god to suit yourself, and it's a transgression of the first and the second of the Ten Commandments, a non-existent god. To believe in the theory of evolution just takes a great leap of blind faith. Like little children, evolutionists believe without the need of a thread of evidence. The theory doesn't disprove the existence of God, it just reveals that those who believe it are truly capable of faith in the invisible, and confirms Napoleon's great observation, man will believe anything as long as it's not in the Bible. Thank you.
The subject of debate is there a God? The subject is not the validity of scientific principles. First of all, they treat the theory of evolution, unbelievably, as if it's a branch of science unto itself. And actually, and if I'm not mistaken, Frank, please correct me, I understand that really evolutionary precepts really came about because so many disparate branches of science started to show an interrelationship. And it is this interrelationship between the various branches in which this theory, which is testable, and which is, and I agree with Carl Sagan, fact that has developed to help us explain who or what we are. It does not address origins, and it does not address purpose. We are the only ones who are able to put purpose in our lives. Of course, the theist has no purpose in his life unless it is externally imposed like a tattoo from somewhere else. And I find that to be really insulting, that we cannot have purpose and meaning in our lives unless we submit to something that will instill that purpose in us. But they have never demonstrated, of course, that purpose must be externally imposed. He claims that we create a God to suit ourselves. We're not a religion. There are 33,000 denominations of Christianity. There are sects of Hindus, Buddhists. It is the theist world that what they do is they form pockets where they agree on a god to suit themselves. That's why, of course, the Hindus do not believe in a Jewish god. The Jews, of course, do not believe in Allah. The Muslims do not believe in the Native American gods. The Native American gods do not believe in a Christian god. And all of them disagree with the Shintos. And we agree with them. We absolutely agree with them. We're not out to create any gods. However, we are out to try and know. There's a big difference between believing something and wanting to know something. For the atheist, such issues as faith or just accepting just doesn't work out. We want to know it. We want to understand it. We want to experience it, because this is, in fact, the only life we have. And we can't be wasting time on what ifs when we have so much to know about what is. Ray is right. I was not a Christian for those 35 years. And that's why it never took. I was fooling myself into thinking I may have been. Then I found a group of people called atheists. And I realized that these were people who had a much greater lust for life than any believer could possibly have. These were the people who were willing to take the unknown, and instead of turning the unknown into some fearful barbarity, which we will face when we drop dead, they take the unknown and they make it a playground for for knowledge, for inquiry, for expressing doubt. And one of the things that I've always admired about atheists is that we have our strength lies in our ability to disagree. Because it is that basic conflict of disagreement which is at the very basis even of the universe itself, as quantum physics shows us. The basic building blocks even of matter are in constant conflict. And so should we be. The day we all agree on something is the day we close up this organization and form a church. So I would like to thank you all. I stand by my position. I don't think one shred of evidence was shown that a God existed, that it was really essentially preaching and appeals. I'd like to thank Mr. Comfort for coming here and spending time with us. I'd like to thank you for being patient with us. Thank you.